and gentlemen. Very glad to be here with you this evening. Once again, my name is Ricky Nye, host du jour for Crawfish Fiesta. Right here where you're tuned to WAIF Cincinnati. Turn this stuff down. Okay, we just heard Robin and Joni Lacey. It's from the disc called Have No Fear, Choo Choo Baby. Before that, we heard the great Alan Toussaint, one of the great New Orleans songwriters with Working in a Coal Mine, a hit for Lee Dorsey. Before that, we heard Buckwheat Zydeco with Mavis Staples doing This Train. Shoefly was Bo Dallas with the Rebirth Brass Band, and kicking off this set was the Meters with Sissy Strut. All right, stay tuned for the Chris and Rob Late Night Talk Show. Their subject is chess. So they'll be checking in with you listeners, and it's going to be heavy. So glue your dial to 88.3 FM Cincinnati, and y'all have a good evening. Bonsoir.
How's it going, Rob?
It's going fine today, Chris. I am thrilled to death to be talking about chess tonight because I don't know if you know this or not, but I am darn near brilliant. I know that you are one
Whoa. You're what? You're darn near what?
Brilliant. And I know that you're one of these tobacco-chewing rubes, and your idea of a game of skill and expertise is mumbly peg.
What's mumbly peg?
Pretend like you don't know, you cornhole expert, you.
I'll tell you, I don't know much about mumbly peg or cornhole, but...
you don't.
I've got my neighborhood record for Gnipkinop.
That's where you shoot the three balls through the holes?
Yeah, you remember...
You probably cheated. Threatened the other children with a pocket knife of some sort.
You're an idiot. I'm Chris.
And I'm Rob.
Together,
we're the Chris and Rob Late Night Talk Show.
And the oldest game known to man is probably Go.
Withholding
from China.
Payment from a...
Okay. What?
Withholding payment, you know, because they always say the oldest profession in the world
is hookering. Yeah.
So the oldest game in the world would be withholding payment from a hooker.
Hey, how'd the Reds do tonight?
It's 4-4 and a knife.
Oh, it's tied.
So, what'd you say? The oldest game in the world is Go Fish?
That's the oldest card game in the world. There's a Chinese game called Go that is like billions of years old. But then after that comes chess. No one knows who invented chess or who the first chess player was. But in a moment, we're going to talk to David Schenck, who I think we'll find out for sure. I think David's originally from Cincinnati. Now he lives in Brooklyn now. And he wrote the definitive history of the immortal game, A History of Chess, by David Schenck. So we're going to talk to Schenck in a minute. And I was thinking, you know what would be fun?
What?
To play a live chess game right here on the radio. I don't think radio has ever been as exciting since the olden days when they first had baseball announcers as if we started a new trend of radio chess. Like we could sit here and be like Queen's Knight to Queen's third spot, and then you go like, make your move.
Mine would be Bishop Pawn to two squares ahead to Bishop 5.
And then my move would be like King's Bishop to Bishop 8, checkmate. Ah, gotcha. See, now that would be good radio. People would be glued to their transistor radios. You wouldn't be able to pry them away from the radio.
They'd be betting. Mm-hmm. There'd be wagering going on. The people would flip the board. There would be fantasy chess leagues. They would have drafts. You could draft fantasy chess players.
Right, like I could have Bobby Fischer and you could have Kasparov.
We all ought to get together at some chicken wing restaurant and have a draft of chess players. I would take Deep Blue.
Maybe I would trade Spassky for Deep Blue or something. I could trade you Boris Spassky for Deep Blue. That would be fun.
I would take Dr. Spock.
Oh, because Dr. Spock can play 3D chess.
And I would take the Wookiee because the Wookiee will rip your arms off if he loses. All the great chess players. You give me Spock, the Wookiee, and Deep Blue.
And you got it?
And I got it.
This is the Chris and Rob Late Night Talk Show on WAIF. Our phone number is 513-749-1444. And hey, Rob.
Hey, Chris.
What is uppermost on your mind?
Funkin'. Uppermost. Uppermost.
WRF as a community radio station serves only to open its airwaves to responsible, divergent points of view. The opinions expressed on this program do not reflect the views of WAIF, its staff, or Board of Trustees. They reflect Chris and Rob's views or the views of their guests. Thank you for listening to WAIF Cincinnati. And now, grinding sacred cows into Radio Hamburger, here's your hosts, the two and only Chris and Rob, starring in the Chris and Rob Late Night Talk Show. To be on tonight's program, call now, 749-1444. Or if you're calling from outside the 275 loop, put a 513 before it and call 513-749-1444. And make sure to check out Chris and Rob on the internet at cincinnatiatlas.com. And now, finally, here's Chris and Rob.
So here we are once again, Robbie, doing this radio show, taking calls, talking to the peoples about the things that matter to them most.
Chris, I love doing this. Each and every week, we get to feel closer to the dirtbags, the scumbuckets, the degenerates, the derelicts.
The people who drink their beer in cans.
The people who make up our audience.
Right.
And I just absolutely look forward to this. As soon as the show ends, I start looking forward to the next one.
You do?
As soon as it ends, in the car on the way back home, I keep thinking, man, when do we get to do that again? It's always so much daggone fun.
And it's usually a week later.
Just about. Yeah, it's crazy how that works out.
In case it's the first time you tuned in, we do this every Tuesday night. We yell and scream a lot. We take calls. We tell people that George Bush is evil. And it's a good thing to do, and somebody's got to do it. And here we are. So, again, 513-749-1444, the Chris and Rob Show. And what's going on this week, Rob, that the people need to know about?
Well, what's going on this week, Chris, that the people need to know about is if you're going to go outside, you might want to wear
galoshes. Maybe some rubbers and a raincoat.
Does anybody still slip over galoshes over their existing shoes?
I am right now. See,
when you're a little kid, you always wore these big black rubber boots with buckles on the front, mm-hmm. or else like rubber band things on the side. And then at some point, you decide that's just not cool. And like eighth grade, you decide. Well, younger than that. He's like fifth grade. You decide, you know what? Having wet feet is a heck of a lot cooler than wearing those boots. And so you go to school with wet feet, and you suffer throughout the whole day, and then you get the athlete's foot. And then you're bleeding between your big toe and your middle ring finger toe. Because you went to school with wet shoes and socks because you didn't want to wear those cool boots.
Didn't your mom always tell you to take off your wet socks when you get to school so you don't catch cold?
But then the teacher would say, hey, hillbilly, we don't walk around here barefoot in this class.
Well, I'm going to catch a cold if I don't take my socks off. My feet are all going to be all wet.
These are the controversies that we tackle here on the Chris and Rob Show each and every week. So if this is the first time you tuned in, you know, we're not going to talk about the Israeli-Lebanese Middle East conflict. We're not going to talk about big issues about having evolution in school and Darwinism and all that. We're not going to sit here and talk about, you know, what's right and wrong with the city government and if we need more traffic lights and stuff. We're talking about the important issues like how to avoid catching a cold.
I don't think it's proper for kids to be going around barefoot in school.
But what if their socks are wet?
But that puts too much pressure on the janitor.
What, because they got all these little wet footprints running around?
No, to actually clean the floor.
Gotta clean the floor. Because these kids eat stuff up off the floor. They drop their french fries and they spill their milk and they get cookies. You got cookies all over. And these kids pick it up. You can't stop them. You ever try to stop a kid from picking something up off the floor and eating it?
And the kids are walking around. They're going to step on little broken glass.
What's that under your chair? Let me have a bite of that.
It's a french fry from the Italian show earlier.
Hey, when we come back, we're going to talk about the immortal game of chess. That's the game with the rooks and the knights and the little pieces that are made out of wood or sometimes they're made out of marble. And you play them and you win. And when you win, you say checkmate and all that. And some people are very passionate about this game. They'll sit in the park for hours with their grandpa and play chess. Some people are like, yeah, whatever. I got better things to do, you know, play some video games. But we're going to talk about this game. And the thing that's interesting, even if you're not a chess aficionado, which Rob and I, of course, are. We sit around to watch ESPN every weekend when they have the chess tournaments.
Mm-hmm.
But even if you're not an aficionado, the thing about the game of chess is how ancient it is. This game is maybe older than 2,000 years old. This game goes back to before humans had writing.
So if it had been a fourth wise man, he may have brought a travel chess set.
He might have.
To the manger.
That's right. You'd have your gold, your frankincense, your myrrh, and...
The magnetic chess set that you can play on the back of a donkey.
Right. So stay tuned. We'll be back in a moment with David Schenck, the author of The Immortal Game, A History of Chess. And if you're a regular listener of the show, you know Rob and I, we hate these. We don't do author interviews because authors are a dime a dozen. Anybody can write a book about how to have better sex.
Anybody can write a book about that. I can write that book.
I'll
tell you what.
I can write
volumes and volumes.
I can write a better book than you.
I doubt that.
Oh, yeah. Oh, okay. Maybe we'll both write a book. We'll put them both out and see who has better sex. My readers or your readers?
Because I would write it with... I wouldn't use ink.
Oh, you wouldn't?
We'll just put it that way.
Okay. It's Chris and Rob Show, WAIF.
Ibrahim. 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 Mustafa, Mustafa, Ibrahim. Mustafa, 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 Ibrahim.
Listening to the Chris and Rob Late Night Talk Show.
Start interviews with guys who write books about chess with a saxophone that sounds like a foghorn. Kind of gets you into the whole chess vibe, you know what I mean? But we played a song by Queen there because it was the only band I could think named after a chess piece. I don't have any records by the Rooks.
What about the Kings?
There's always Stephen Bishop,
there's
right?
There's Kingsman.
There's the Kingsman.
Got it. Chess Records.
Yeah, that's right. I was looking for like an old B.B. King record on Chess Records. We should have played that. Hey, we got a guy here who wrote a book about chess, and it's chock full of information. Chess is an ancient, old game. It's a lot older than Monopoly, I'll tell you that. And David Schenck, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, guys.
Hey, we're going to be talking about chess here, and, you know, as we said before we introduced you, some people are very passionate about the game. Other people don't know much about it, but should pay attention because the story of how the game grew and developed and came along is almost like the story of civilization itself, isn't it?
It's amazing how chess is this this lens onto the last 1,500 years of our history, and it's the only game that I know of that has been around for this long in an uninterrupted fashion and is used by everyone around for centuries and centuries.
It's also a something that you use in literature and poetry to express ideas because of the concept of how these pieces interact with each other. They translate themselves to poetry very well.
Yeah, that's right. It's really actually been a absolutely extraordinary metaphor, very adaptable, used in literature, used in religious imagery, used in mathematical inquests, used in scientific investigations. It's amazing how adaptive this little game is.
Now, you're going to be in town here in a couple of days, right?
Yeah, I grew up in Cincinnati, and I'm coming back to do a reading at Joseph Beth Bookstore on Thursday night at 7.
Joseph Beth is over in the Hyde Park, Norwood area. Most people will know where it's at. If not, they can get out the phone book. Joseph Beth, Thursday night, a book signing with David Schenck. And you're from Cincinnati, huh?
Yeah, I grew up in Wyoming and went to Wyoming Public Schools.
Really?
Yeah.
How about that? I bet you know my cousin.
Could be.
Okay, we won't play that game right now. All right, if anybody wants to call in and ask some questions or even talk about chess strategy, because David Schenck's great-great-great-grandpa was like a chess grandmaster, and he knows all the moves and the different terminology and how to kill your opponent with this defense and that gambit and all this. If you want to call in and talk about chess or anything, 513-961-8900. That's 513-961-8900. David, when was the first chess game played?
Well, you know what? We're never going to know that for sure, but we do know that the game goes back at least 1,500 years. It was originally a four-person game in India, and by the time it got over to neighboring Persia, which is now Iran, of course, about 1,500 years ago, it became a two-person war game. And there's all sorts of amazing stories about how the game was invented, but, of course, they're probably all made up. But we do know the game is that old.
And the rules weren't originally what they are now. The pieces had slightly different moves originally than they do now, right?
Yeah, there are a bunch of differences, pretty slight. I mean, some of the moves, what's most amazing is that some of the pieces were exactly the same and had exactly the same move. For instance, the rook, same name, same move. The pawn was called a foot soldier in ancient Persian. Same move, virtually the same move as it has today, and the same way of capturing other pieces. The knight was a horse and was also exactly the same move as it is now. And then there were a couple differences, but those got ironed out over the centuries.
I always thought the knight should have been called the drunk because it seems to stagger.
You know, I think of it as the opposite way. I think he's the most cunning. You can't see him coming.
He goes up a couple, then he stumbles to the left, like how I walk home from Bob's. Two steps frontwards, one step to the left. Then I just sit there and catch my breath for a while.
That's also how you dance, Rob.
And then two steps forward and one steps to the right.
Maybe they should have called that piece the dancer. Because you dance that way. I've seen you dance at wedding receptions.
Well, so, if you end up, if at the end of that dance you end up clubbing some big guy with a crown on his head, then yeah, I think the parallel is perfect.
So when did they get the, okay, so We got the military stuff with the foot soldier and the knight. When did the Catholic Church get involved with the bishop?
Well, first you got to first quickly gloss over the first 300 or 400 years, which was pre-Christian. I mean, it was after Christ was born, but it really didn't have any interaction with Christians. It was mostly a game played by Muslims during the formation of their empire, and they're the ones that took it throughout the Middle East and into North Africa and then into Europe. And it was about 1,000 years ago that it first got into Christian Europe, and they loved it. I mean, it's amazing. There's no country that didn't love this game. It's kind of like wherever it arrived, it became a part of that new culture.
Now, did the game come out of the Middle East? Some people might think, oh, it's a medieval game. But white guys from Europe didn't invent the game in the year 1000. Wasn't it invented maybe by somebody in Asia or in India or something?
It was definitely invented by someone or a series of people somewhere in the area of China, India, Persia, kind of the old Silk Road trade routes, the most ancient part of civilization where these guys used to travel along these roads with spices and other valuables, and probably over several centuries they cobbled together this game. But really, as we know it, it appears in Persia about 1,500 years ago.
And was it originally called Checkers Plus?
It's originally called that game with the guy who does that drunk dance around the board.
Yeah. Well, which is first, checkers or chess?
That's a good question. That's a really good question.
What about Chinese checkers? Where do they fit in?
I think that chess is actually older, believe it or not, but I'm not. They used to call chess draughts and checkers draughts, and I'm really not sure how far checkers goes back, but I'm going to have to look that up.
If we had the Mr. Sherman and Peabody Wayback Machine, and we went to Delhi, New Delhi, or whatever, 1,500 years ago, would they be using the traditional black and white checkered board like we use today and like what checkers uses?
Great question. For the first 300 or 400 years, no. It was the same size board, same geometry, 64 squares, and they did have two armies, and they were different colors. They actually, I think, tended to be either green and kind of off-white or red and off-white. But they did not have the checkered board until it got to Europe. And when you think about it, the checkered board, the black and white squares, are actually not critical to the game. They kind of now represent the game by, you know, looking at it. But you actually don't need those checkered squares to be able to play chess.
You need checks, though. Don't you need boxes?
You need boxes, yes. But, I mean, what they didn't have was the black and white squares. They had the squares.
You could have green and red.
Or kind of mono-colored squares.
But that may make it harder. Because when you're first learning, and you know, well, your bishop's on a white one.
Yeah.
How did you attack my knight on a black square?
Yeah, exactly.
Dude, that always happens when you're like seven and you're playing. Somehow right. The bishop leaves the white squares and makes it to the black squares and picks off your piece.
I can tell you were scarred in, you know, like first grade when you played this game.
Well, you know, people were doing that to me all the time, and I finally realized how to play.
Rob, were you in chess club in high school?
No, I was not in chess club in high school.
Well, you were busy dating women?
I was
women?
Too busy smoking cigarettes and drinking Strohs.
Okay, what about you, David?
Beating up kids from Wyoming.
Were you in chess club in high school?
I was too busy listening to the Grateful Dead.
Oh, man. Oh, okay.
Passing lefties in the parking lot of Wyoming, huh?
There you go. Now I know where my cousin used to get it from.
So why is it a castle? I don't understand. A rook looks like a castle,
yeah.
But yet it moves. We understand a horse can move, a bishop can move, a queen and a king and a foot soldier can all obviously move.
Yeah.
But this rook looks like the tower where Rapunzel is stuck.
Yeah.
But yet it moves. I don't. Do you have any insight into that?
You know, to be honest, that's always bothered me. The answer really is that this is originally the makeup of an army in Persia or India. And the rook didn't used to look like that. In fact, at one point it was called a boat.
A boat?
I think in Russia it's actually still called a boat.
You know, I call my co-host a boat.
But there are some pictures. There are some old pictures of, like, elephants and camels carrying these large, like, castle turret-looking things that kind of look like a rook. And so those are moving around, so that might have been the origin of that look.
So you should imagine that there's an elephant underneath your rook.
But it is kind of ridiculous when they have the ones that really look like it's a castle that should be immovable, and it's actually one of the swiftest pieces on the board.
You know what I think is stupid? You got all these chess boards. You got all these chess boards that they make these days that they try to sell to kids, and you got... Everyone's like characters from The Simpsons, or it's like all like
Star Wind.
Yeah, or it's all Star Wars.
North versus
characters.
South.
You know, and I like a traditional chess piece. I don't want my king to be Homer Simpson and my queen to be Marge, you know? And all my pawns are little Bart Simpsons. I'm not into all that.
Yeah, I have mixed feelings about that, but I think it's kind of funny. I mean, the history of people doing that goes back so far. It's amazing.
Oh, so that's not a new thing the Parker brothers invented.
You know, you want to hear something funny? When they were when the United States first came into formation, a mere couple hundred years ago, a lot of people thought it was bizarre that we should import a game that was all about kings and queens. So they tried to change it here, and they tried to make it president and congressman and crazy stuff like that. But that didn't seem to take.
That sounds like a little novelty Ben Franklin would have liked.
He would have loved it. Ben Franklin was a huge chess fan. You could not. There's second to none. He would play chess with anyone who asked.
Now, would Mr. Spock be the all-time greatest chess player?
I'm sure he was a very good chess player in
that 3D version, right?
Yeah, a lot of people have mentioned that to me. A lot of people have mentioned that to me. And there are people who attempt to play 3D chess, but my own feeling is that 2D chess is complicated enough.
You mean there actually are rules for a three-dimensional chess game? It's not just some science fiction thing they invent to put in a scene?
No, it actually exists. There are all sorts of variants. Lots of people now get together and try to play chess by the old rules and things like that. But
you mean by the old rules where the queen isn't as powerful and the king
exactly,
can do more
yeah.
stuff?
Exactly, yeah. That's right.
All right. That's kind of like you get the musicians together to play the Baroque music, but they're playing it on timely instruments that are usually broken rather than some of the newfangled instruments that usually work.
I think that's a good analogy.
Yeah. Or they do with the baseball. They do the underhanded nine balls as a walk and all that kind of stuff with the 1860s baseball crap.
Yeah.
It's just a way of kind of tinkering with it, but what's pretty clear at this point is that the game... The universal form of the game is I think set in stone and is not going to change and is going to be around. When you think about it, this is a game that's been around longer than any other thing about almost any other thing about civilization you can name. You can't name a food or a language or even an idea that's been around as long as chess.
It's older than the Bible, isn't it?
It's older than the Bible.
Yeah. Hey, we're talking to David Schenk, who wrote a book about chess called The Immortal Game, A History of Chess. And if you would like to call in and say hello to the author, or if you have any questions about chess and what it's all about, we can take your calls at 513-961-8900. As is usually the case on our show, no question is too dumb. So call in, 961-8900. And before we, I want to start talking about some more modern stuff, like Bobby Fischer and these computers and stuff. But before we get to that... While we're still talking about some of these ancient games, are you familiar with this game out of China called Go, where you get the little piece and you flip it over and it's either black or white and you surround your players?
I know a little bit about it. I know that a lot of chess people are really into it.
It's supposed to be even older than chess.
It is older than chess. I can definitely attest to that. And it's a very complex... It's one of the only games that's even more complex than chess.
Mm-hmm. Have you played it?
I have not.
It's been a long time, but I played I knew a guy who had a bag of these pieces that you play, and it is. There's a game that Parker Brothers makes that's similar to it, but you got to surround your opponent's pieces by putting down one piece at a time. When you do, you flip them all over to your color, and they're like a little two-sided disc. One side's white, one side's black, and you flip them over as you go. And when you can flip every piece over to your color, you win. And it's hard to get all the pieces because as soon as you surround the other guy, he surrounds your pieces.
Right.
So that's just that. There was one theory about, or one like legend about how chess was invented that came out of India about this queen whose son was a warrior and who died in battle. It's a beautiful story. Could you tell us about that?
Yeah, sure. I mean, this is typical of a lot of the myths, but this is a story about a queen who had one, her only son was supposed to be the heir to the throne. And he went out in battle, and he died. And so there was this big discussion about how they should break the news to the queen. And this is very illustrative of how chess ended up being used to explain things and to explore things, and kind of as allegory. It's really a beautiful story. So what happened was the philosopher came up with this idea that he would invent a game, kind of a mini battle scene, to show the queen what had happened. And there are actually a lot of different versions of the story, but basically he supposedly invents this game, and everyone starts talking about it, and the queen hears about it, and the queen demands to see it, and she comes over, and she says, well, tell me about this game that everyone's talking about. And he shows her the game, And as soon as he shows her the game and shows her how, you know, the king is you know, the quest of the game is that the you capture the king or you checkmate the king, she looked up and said, "My son is dead, isn't he?" And he said, "You have said it." And she says, "Okay, well, now let's begin the mourning." So she got the message through this game.
That's kind of illustrative of how that allegory can be used to communicate a lot of stuff.
It's just amazing. People would not believe until you read the book just how many different ways chess is used. I mean, the really famous one in the Middle Ages is that this guy decided to explain how people fit into society versus compared to other people, like how an innkeeper is should be compared in social standing to a pharmacist and a doctor and you know, obviously a king and a queen and a knight, and used chess as this whole construction and wrote this book all about it and called it The Morals of Chess, The Morality of Chess, and it was the second most popular book in Europe in the Middle Ages next to the Bible.
Wow. Nobody could read then either, though.
Hey, we're talking to David Schenk, who wrote a book about chess called The Immortal Game, A History of Chess. He'll be up at Joseph Beth on Thursday night at 7 o'clock doing a book signing, and y'all can go up there and you'll be playing games while you're there, right? There'll be chess boards out you can all play.
There'll be people playing games, and we're actually giving away a really cool chess set. It's a reproduction of a 12th century set that I tell the story of in the book. It's these incredible pieces, very lifelike, that were found in outside of Scotland, in a little island outside of Scotland. They were found about 200 years ago, but it turns out they were made almost 1,000 years ago. And they were made not in Scotland, but in Norway, and they traveled this huge distance, and then were used supposedly, and then must have been buried for 600 or 700 years, and then were dug up. And it's an incredible story, and the pieces are incredible.
So you couldn't get your publisher to spring for the Bugs Bunny chess set, huh?
Yeah, I tried. No, we wanted the Simpsons set, but
you know,
this is an incredible set, and someone's gonna win it in Cincinnati.
Just so people, if anybody's into this kind of stuff, knows, this book is not one of these chess books that's full of chess problems and it's some kind of thought-provoking chess thing. It's all for people who play. It's a book about the history of the game, and so it's very readable to someone who doesn't play every day. It's not like one of these...
Yeah, I really wrote it for... All my books are written with my mom in mind.
All your books?
Yeah.
What other books have you written?
Oh, boy. How much time do you have?
Nice research, Chris.
All right, I know. It says on the flap. I'm setting them up, all right? So shut up.
No. This is actually my fifth book, and I have the privilege to write about lots of different topics. I have the dream job as far as I'm concerned.
Mm-hmm.
But this is very much for a general audience. I wanted to understand the majesty and mystery of chess, and I wanted to try to explain that to casual chess players, to people who don't even really know anything about the game but maybe have just heard about it, and hopefully the serious chess players will appreciate it too, but you know, they already have hundreds of books, and it's certainly not a book to teach people how to play great chess.
Okay, let's get past the commercial here. We're taking your phone calls at 513-961-8900 to say hello to David Schenk. Hello, Charlie, you're on the air.
Yeah, I won't shift gears too quick here. So can I... computer beat a man at chess yet?
Can a computer beat a man at chess
yet? Anything can beat this man.
Uh-huh.
A computer can beat a man at chess almost, let's take this statement as to the extreme, almost every computer can beat almost every man and woman now. They really have made, they've been able to develop them so intelligently that there are very few people left who can successfully play against
the good computers. Yeah, but I mean, there are men that are better than the computer. They were having this match. Wasn't it Bobby Fischer or somebody kept taking on the big computer?
Charlie, you always blow my mind when you call.
I got more questions.
The dude lost, Charlie.
Hold on, just a second.
Okay,
wait.
Go ahead. The guy lost.
You talked about your mom. Did you mention her? Because I think, didn't your mom used to give nature talks or something?
Didn't your mom used to give nature talks?
I grew up in Wyoming.
In Wyoming.
I don't think so.
Did any Shank give a nature talk in Wyoming?
Shank giving a nature talk.
I might have
to. I don't know. We had, you know, trees in our backyard, so.
There you go, Charlie.
You didn't grow up on Burns, did you?
Did you grow up on Burns?
No, I'm sorry.
Did you used to hang out at the Dairy Queen down on Winton Road?
Hey, Red.
All right, listen, thanks for your call, Charlie.
All right, thank you, Charlie.
Maybe next time, Charlie, when you meet David Shank in a bar, you can talk about all this stuff, all right?
All right.
That brings up, though, we were going to get into it. We mentioned Deep Blue earlier and the idea of computers beating humans and all that stuff. What's the relative history of computers playing humans in chess?
Well, they've been working on it for about 40 years, and in the late 90s, they finally came up with Deep Blue, which did beat the world champion at the time, Garry Kasparov, and he actually was probably the only person in the world who didn't really recognize that he had lost. He managed to find all these different ways of accusing the people who developed the machine of cheating, but everyone else thought he'd lost. And since then, the computers have gotten even better. And now, what's really kind of funny is that Deep Blue was kind of famously this gigantic IBM machine that filled up a living room. Well, now you can get a piece of software, you know, download it over the internet, and put it on your cheapo laptop, and it will crush just about any chess player, human chess player around.
And this is some kind of like a human philosophical science fiction question about when machines surpass human intellect. And are you saying that this event, when this computer beat the world's greatest chess player, Garry Kasparov, that marked some moment in human history where we finally invented a machine that's smarter than us?
Well, I don't think you can say that the machine is really smarter than us, but it certainly sent a chill down people's spines as the beginning of a new era where we're going to be seeing machines that can solve problems that are so complex that we have to call them intelligent. And it used to be that we only thought of intelligence, the word intelligence, as a human quality, that only human beings could be intelligent. But they now are developing machines that are so good at solving problems that we have to acknowledge that there's some kind of intelligence going on. It's not the same kind of intelligence that we have. It works totally differently.
So if I'm playing Garry Kasparov, I'm going to move a pawn, and I'm going to think, well, what the hell, I hope I last two more moves. But Deep Blue moves a pawn, and then he immediately runs through the millions and millions and millions of possible moves.
Trillions.
That could be made in the next move, and then his next move, and then he's working. He can map out the millions of different ways the game could end immediately. Then he can get rid of all the ones that end with Deep Blue losing, and he makes the move that has Deep Blue winning. So it's a completely different way of intelligence.
That's true, but although it does need to be pointed out that even a machine as fast as Deep Blue can't calculate a whole game. It can only really calculate a couple of moves because the game is so complex. And in fact, although people would assume that by now we might have we have computers that could just crunch a whole, you know, a whole chess game and just learn everything there is to learn about chess and just know the answer. As a matter of fact, that's not going to be possible for thousands of years. There are so many possibilities in chess. The number is actually 10 to the 120th power.
That's a big number.
120 zeros. In fact, I just did a event at a bookstore here, and my daughter came, and we wrote out 120 zeros on one of those long piece of calculator paper, and we showed it to people in the audience, and it stretched to be about 10 or 15 feet long.
Will you have that paper with you in Cincinnati? That could be a real crowd pleaser.
I'm bringing that paper, and I'm going to ask for some volunteers. Unfortunately, my daughter's not going to be with me, but maybe we'll get some kids to hold it up in Cincinnati.
Now, here's a great way to win yourself some money, David Shank, author of The Immortal Game, History of Chess.
I'll tell you a way to win some money off of chess here in a minute.
Okay, you go into the local chess club, and I'm assuming you're a average to good player.
I'm average to mediocre.
Okay, you're
average to average.
You're mediocre to average player. Okay, what you do is you take 10 cats, and you say, I will play 10 guys at once, and I will break even. I will not lose more than I will win. And then you also, you pick out like the second or third best player in the whole club, one of them who's probably kind of cocky, mm-hmm. and you say, but I guarantee I won't lose to you, big mouth. And you make a bet with him, right?
Yeah.
Then you know how to, you know what, you, then you know what you do?
What?
Okay, you actually play a game with the first five guys.
Yeah.
And then you just mimic their moves with players 6 through 10. So you're just copying 1 through 5 on 6 through 10.
Yeah.
So they're actually playing each other. And whatever the very best player in the club does, that's what you do to the third best player in the club. So you got the very best player at table number 1 and say this guy that you made the side bet with at table number 10. So whatever player number 1 does, you do the exact same thing on player number 10. So really you got the best player in a club playing third best player in the club.
Okay, is this Chris or Rob?
This is Rob, and you can make some big money doing that.
Okay, Rob, I think that you got I think you have the right spirit, but I think you're getting the scheme a little wrong.
It works for me all the time, dude.
I'm sure it does.
In my local chess club.
And I'm going to come over and check out your house. I'm sure you've got some kind of palace that you built with chess money.
Yeah, the chess money's flowing here in the Natty, dude.
But I think, see, the problem with that scheme is you can't be sure what your opponent is gonna play.
Can I tell you something, David?
Yeah.
If you're a hustler,
yeah.
you might lose on Tuesday. But you're going to probably win Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday. So there's always you can never be afraid of losing. When you're hustling, there's always a chance you're going to lose. But the real hustler knows that he's going to win more than he loses over a given amount of time.
Right.
So even if this thing blows up in your face at the Manhattan Chess Club, yeah. it'll work at the Bronx Chess Club, the Staten Island Chess Club, and the Brooklyn Chess Club. So you'll be okay.
Well, what I've heard. And, you know, I'll take a back seat to you in the chess hustling department.
And we're some slinky, too, that works. Works for me, anyway.
But what I've heard is what people have done is they make a bet with a really good player.
Right.
And say, I'll play you in a correspondence game. And I guarantee you, see, how does this work out? I think they,
what do you mean correspondence game for our listeners?
Okay, so in other words, like you mail games to moves to each other either over email or regular mail. So it's you're not sitting over a board playing in real time. You're playing a game over, you know, like a couple weeks' time.
Okay.
So what you do is you then play another grandmaster and you reverse the board like you're saying.
Right.
So you are actually playing the same game, I think. I need to think this through, though.
No, you're doing it exactly right. You have a dude that's a grandmaster. You're copying his moves against a dude who's only a master. And
yeah.
Then you take him out, and he thinks all you're doing is you're just parroting somebody, and you're beating him. But enough about how to hustle. Let's get back to your book.
Okay.
It's called The Immortal Game, David Schenck. It's a history of chess. And when you were looking around for things to write history about, why chess? Why not professional female softball players?
Right. Well, professional female softball is almost as old as chess, but I think chess is about 6 years older, so I thought, you know. I've written books on a number of different topics, and my last book, believe it or not, was about Alzheimer's disease, and I have kind of specialized a little bit in writing about the mind and the brain. And I also like writing about history. And when I discovered that chess was as old as it is, I assumed, like a lot of people, that you know it was maybe 400 or 500 years old. When I discovered it was 1,500 years old, then that kind of made me curious. And I looked deeper and deeper into it. And when I realized how important it was to human history, I just thought this is a great subject for me because I get to talk about the mind. I get to talk about why chess appeals to the mind, what it does for the mind, which turned out to be a much richer story than I could have imagined. And I get to tell all these great stories from history, so it worked out well.
I want to talk about Bobby Fischer. A lot of chess players are crazy.
Who's Bobby Fischer, Chris?
Well, our author's going to tell us that. But a lot of chess players are crazy, and this Bobby Fischer keeps making headlines even to this day by doing crazy stuff. So tell us briefly a brief synopsis of the career and the history of Bobby Fischer, and what's the deal with this guy? He's nuts.
Well, Bobby Fischer is probably the best American ever to play chess, and he's famous because he at the height of the Cold War, or one of the heights of the Cold War, he took on the Soviet chess machine, which was pretty formidable because they had a lot of really good players, and they had these kind of sneaky ways of helping each other, which we didn't have in the U.S. And so it was basically one guy, really a great kind of American cowboy story, one guy against this whole legion of Soviet grandmasters. And he was pretty unstable emotionally and mentally even back then, but shortly after he became champion of the world, he really kind of went off the deep end. And it's really a sad story. And for me, I think you just need to compare, you know, Bobby Fischer to, say, a great legendary quarterback who loses, you know, an arm or a leg or something. You know, it's a tragedy for any athlete or any competitor to lose part of, you know, what makes them so great. And in Bobby Fischer's case, he lost his mind. He's just really not a well person. He's clinically very sick, and he does a lot of very bizarre things, but it's all the same story. It's all just a part of his mental illness now.
You want to talk a little bit about him and 9/11 and that business with Yugoslavia?
Sure. Well, after, before 9/11, he was in need of some money. He got offered to do a big chess match in Yugoslavia, and at the time it was against the law. There was an economic sanctions against Yugoslavia. And you were not allowed to do business with that country. And so Fischer went over there and made $1 million, I think, in this chess match, and was basically a fugitive in the United States. And he basically at that point became an enemy of the United States and never came back and has been denouncing the U.S. in all these kind of crazy ways. And when 9/11 happened after that, he came out immediately on the radio and came out in favor of the attack, which was kind of an odd thing to hear from a person who was not and is not a radical Muslim. He doesn't have anything. He doesn't have any connection to Al Qaeda or anything like that. He's just a guy who hates America for his own reasons of his own illness, as I alluded to earlier, and has said all sorts of ridiculous things, and it's just, as I said, it's just a sad thing to see someone crumble like that.
What do you think that even when he was at the height of his chess powers, that maybe that kind of went hand in hand, that brilliance was real close to madness all the time?
I think that I think it's pretty complex, but I think a lot of people who first of all, you have to have the drive to become that great. You have to just want to spend all of your time and really devote your life to a pursuit like that. And when it's chess, you're devoting your whole waking life to thinking in these two dimensions, which may sound kind of innocuous, but if all you're doing is thinking about how these pieces are going to try to knock out other pieces, it really becomes a pretty strange world for you. And I think people who are not emotionally balanced to begin with can if they devote years and years and years of playing chess and just living inside that world, can actually do themselves some harm.
And you mentioned Kasparov wouldn't admit that he was defeated by the computer. Is he wrapped tight enough, or is he sort of not wrapped tight enough?
Oh, no. That's a completely different story. Kasparov has no issues with mental illness that I know of. Kasparov, and I need to say, there are many, the vast majority of superb chess players do not have any problems with mental illness. It's a small sliver of the chess population. Kasparov's story is that he's just got this incredible ego, and when he lost to Deep Blue, he was so wounded that he lashed out and accused the guys who were behind the machine of cheating, which you know, may sound plausible when you don't hear the details, but if you know the details like I do, and the kind of integrity of the people who were who helped to create this machine, it's absolutely absurd. And what's really sad is Kasparov is a multi-millionaire, very powerful and rich. And we're talking about a handful of guys who are never going to be rich, who are never going to be famous. And they did this thing, and they had this great achievement. And in return, they got called cheaters and liars by this guy who, just to save his own ego, did this thing.
You and I would do the same thing if we got beat by a computer. Ah, it's just a computer. It's just a bunch of, yeah.
Well, I might throw the computer on the floor, but I hope I wouldn't accuse the guy who made the computer of cheating.
And every once in a while you hear about like some Chinese kid or some kid out of the ghetto will show up and he can beat everybody on the planet. Are any of those stories ever true? Are there really these 11-year-old savant chess guys running around, and how do the old people react to them?
Well, they're great kids. I mean, they're kids who are great chess players. It is a myth, an enormous myth that they come out of nowhere. I mean, I think the people imagine that that, you know, a kid sees his father play chess and watches a couple games quietly, you know, and then he sits down at the board and starts checkmating people and kind of has this instant chess knowledge, and that's really not the way it happens. You know, there are, people can have an aptitude for geometric thinking, which is what chess is, and people can, you know, can have all sorts of aptitudes, but you have to put in an enormous, enormous amount of time and energy to be truly good at this game. There's no substitute for that.
Okay. David Schenk wrote a book called The Immortal Game, A History of Chess, and he'll be at the Joseph Beth Bookstore Thursday at 7 o'clock. He's going to have a big, long piece of paper with a bunch of zeros on it. He's going to have some chess games going on. It'll be like a hanging out at the bookstore kicking butt. So everybody check it out if you're into this sort of thing.
So when did you graduate from Wyoming High School?
1984.
Yeah, you do know one of my cousins, but we won't go there.
Okay.
Those guys were nuts, man.
It was a pretty calm high school. I didn't know anyone who was nuts, but we can swap some stories off the air.
Yeah, it ain't no thing. People in Cincinnati do that. It's cheesy. They don't do that in other towns. If you do an interview in St. Louis, they're not all like, well, hey, what high school did you go to?
What neighborhood are you guys broadcasting from?
We're in Walnut Hills, baby.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Awesome. Yeah, I know some people went to Walnut Hills. So.
Yeah.
So why did you leave Cincinnati?
Why did I leave Cincinnati? Well, I left to go to college.
Well, you're thinking, why did we stay, aren't you?
No. I don't know. What can I say? When I was in high school, I just wanted to get out. I wanted to go east, and there's just been a lot of exciting things happening for me in other cities. But I come back all the time. There's no better ice cream than Grater's, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
So
you're in Brooklyn now, right?
Yeah.
Now you ever go get the deep fried Twinkies?
Up at the chip shop.
The chip shop?
Deep fried Twinkies.
At the chip shop, the British chip shop there. What's it called?
It's in
Park Slope.
Check that out.
Yeah. Park Slope.
It's in Park Slope, Brooklyn. It's
I know
the
chip shop in Park Slope. I live about 10 blocks away from it.
Okay, what about Bar Bays every Tuesday night with the Slavic Soul Party? You ever check that out?
I was just there last week.
Yeah, well, next Tuesday, go down to Bar Bays.
Okay.
Check out the Slavic Soul Party and tell those guys that Chris and Rob said hello.
How do you guys know about that stuff?
What about
we're cool?
What about that high school where Mr. Cotter teaches?
Hey, which one is that?
Is that like Roosevelt High or something?
And all the Sweat Hogs, you mean?
Yeah. That's in Brooklyn.
Yeah, they're right down the street. The Sweat Hogs, John Travolta, he's still about 21.
Yeah, do you go to that disco that he used to go to in Saturday Night Fever?
The 2001 Odyssey?
Yeah, you go to 2001 Odyssey?
How's
that
they've
working?
Got the disco board out in the middle of Prospect Park, and we all just disco all night long.
So what's your favorite work of literature and or cinema that has a chess theme? Like, I always like the Avengers would have some, you know, some crazy, or Batman would have some crazy bad guy who's making you play chess.
There are so many great ones. It's amazing how many movies have touched on it.
Stalag 17, that's how they were contacting the German spy, was getting the messages to the Germans.
Yeah.
With the chess pieces.
I got to go back and look at that. You know, what happened was I thought I was going to gather all those examples, and I gathered, like, you know, a couple dozen of them as I was researching the book, and I realized, well, you know, how many can I use, you know? I mean, I can't make this a catalog of movie references, so. Well, I mean, one of my favorite writers is Nabokov, Vladimir Nabokov, and he was a chess nut. He wrote about chess. He actually constructed chess problems as a part of his life and career. He really, that was important to him. He wrote poetry about chess. He wrote a novel about a chess player who actually loses his mind.
Well, you know, Sting pronounces his name Nabokov.
Oh, right, in the song.
In that song, Sting says, just like that book by Nabokov.
Yeah, I think that I think he had to do that because of the meter of the line, but
okay.
I bet if you drew Sting out in conversation, he would go Nabokov.
Whatever he thought was trendy this week, he'd say.
Yeah.
Okay. Hey, thanks a lot, David.
Thank you, guys. I really enjoyed it.
Okay, we'll do this again sometime.
I'd love to. Take care.
We'll look for you up at the bookstore Thursday night, 7 o'clock at Joseph Bath, The Immortal Game, A History of Chess by David Schenk.
Terrific.
Thanks a lot.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Later.
This is Chris and Rob on WAIF.
A bullet from the back of a bush took Medgar Evers' blood. A finger fired the trigger to his name. Handle hit out in the dark. A hand set the spark. Two eyes took the aim behind a man's brain. But he can't be blamed. He's only a pawn in their game. The South politician preaches to the poor white man. You got more than the blacks, don't complain. You're better than them, you've been born with white skin, they explain. And the Negro's name is used, it is plain, for the politician's gain as he rises to fame. And the poor white remains on the caboose of the train. But it ain't him to blame. He's only a pawn in there.